You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs, with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 112 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I am delighted to be joined this morning by James. Good morning, James.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very, very good. Thanks so much for joining me. You are an actor and a bit of a boxer as well, a screenwriter, and you also have Hirschsprungs as well. So I guess kind of up to you really where you want to start the story.
Yeah, we'll start at the beginning. Hirschsprungs disease. I was diagnosed, I have a little bit of notes here, so don't mind me looking away. I was diagnosed with total congenital Hirschsprungs disease at 3 weeks old, so very, very early on. I had my entire colon and large intestine plus 25 centimeters of ileum or small intestine resected by age four. They had the SOV or SOAV pull-through procedure done through some of that as well. I think that's how you say it. I don't know how to pronounce it really. But yeah, all of that was from 3 weeks old to age six. I had almost 20 surgeries, close to 20, I think, countless procedures, staying sick for months or years at a time. It was an awful experience from what I remember mostly. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds sounds pretty horrific. Especially as well, I mean, 3 weeks, because I always thought 3 weeks was quite early to be diagnosed, because I was 3 weeks as well, or roughly 3 weeks. But I've seen that actually most are getting diagnosed within the first 48 hours. So I guess we were quite late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely had, well, this is coming from what my mom described. Of course, I wasn't conscious yet as a human being, but she described it as by week two, I wasn't eating for like 6 days or something like that at a time. And I was skeletal, super thin, like something, I just clearly was not okay. And I have an older brother who also had Hirschsprungs as well, but he didn't have total. I got destroyed. He just had some of it, which was still awful. But so she's seen it before and she's like, he's not well. Like there's something not right. She said I would wake up from a nap, throw up acid, and then just go right back to bed. Wouldn't eat, refused food. So she's like, that's not normal. Rushed me in and she's like, I need someone to see him. Like he's not okay. I can like apparently see my intestines like through my abdomen because I was so sunk in and like see them moving around and they were all blocked and it was terrible. And so that's why she rushed me in and I had a surgery a week later, saved my life.
Wow. So you have a brother with Hirschsprungs. I presume you said he's not that much of the intestine infected. Was that sort of short segment then, I take it?
Yeah, he's 4.5 years older than me and he has probably still around 50% of his large intestine and colon. So he still has like most of the operating system. I have nothing. So he's like half normal. He still has issues, of course. Like he does have the disease, but he's more on the normal human side, I like to describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has a bit more than you do.
Yes, exactly.
So with that as well, see, having two sons with Hirschsprungs, was there, apart from you and your brother, anything else in the family, sort of anybody else that has Hirschsprungs? Did it sort of come from a long family line, or was it just you two that were affected?
It was just us. My mom has like some inkling of like maybe our dad has it, has had it and just kind of just either denied to get help or whatever it may have been. But she's pretty sure that he did have it somewhere because apparently the female or the mother carries it like through to us, but they don't have it. So it has to come from the male, I guess, in some sort of web of that. So she had nothing, but then had both of us. I was like 100% accuracy. We just both got it immediately. So I don't know, but I think it comes from the male. So we're still not confirmed on if he has it or had it, like physically. So
yeah, wow. I mean, I know it's three in every four roughly how people with Hirschsprungs are male. So it's more. But that's interesting. You say that. Carried potentially through female, and then but actually the more people that get it are male, which I mean, I'm fascinated by genetics, absolutely fascinated. Yeah. And I've spoken to so many people about it and I still don't understand any of it.
Yeah. No idea. Yeah, and that's just a rough, very rough research answer. Like I don't know the specifics, but that's what I've kind of learned or heard about.
No, that makes sense. I mean, to be honest, I don't think even through all the doctors I've spoken to, I don't think anybody properly understands it yet. We're getting there. We're definitely further forward than we were, but I don't think anyone really fully understands, you know, why, you know, like with you and your brother, why do you have different types of Hirschsprungs? You know, shouldn't you, because your brothers both have the same? No.
Yeah.
So I don't get that either.
Yeah, I that's a good question, actually. I never thought of it that way. It was just something that I've always understood. Like, yeah, my brother has half of it. I got 100% of it. And that's just how it was. But that's a good question. I don't know why it came from the same source. So why did, yeah, why? It's bad. I don't know. Yeah.
You're not the only person who asks why. There's lots of us who just, yeah, I think it's such a difficult one, because I just don't know. Nobody's got the answer, and nobody can tell, you know, you or me or anybody else why did we get Hirschsprungs when there was nothing else in the family?
Yeah. I mean, literally nothing. There's no, I mean, that I'm aware of, any like real diseases that run through either side at all. And we just both got one of the worst things. Like, I don't know. I mean, in comparison.
Yeah. And one of the rarest, obviously, as well. Yeah. It's not as though, you know, diabetes or asthma or something else. One of the rarest things you can possibly get. So diagnosed at 3 weeks. You said you've had sort of 20 surgeries by age 6?
Age 6, yeah.
How many of those do you remember?
I only remember the events leading up to some of them, like how I felt when I knew I was going to go get surgery, I think is the only thing that stuck with me, not really remembering the surgery itself. But one particular moment that has always stuck with me is one day. It was like a Saturday morning, very, very young, maybe 3 or 4, in the midst of all the craziness. And it was like a perfect day, crisp air, you know, like just that perfect childhood sun, and like everything's great. And I was finally feeling well after all of this stuff going on. And so I was so excited. And I was like, I actually feel good today. This is incredible. And I run down the stairs to go eat breakfast because I'm all hyped. And my mom's standing by the door with her purse, just looking at me. And I yelled, I was like, I'm going to have high nut Cheerios. Like, I'm like, yeah, like, let's eat. Like, I'm so excited. And then she just looked at me and was like, we have to go to the hospital right now. Like, you have surgery this morning. And I was just like, and I just started bawling. Like, I was, my whole world collapsed. And I was like, what do you mean? I feel great. Like, I just didn't understand that it was already scheduled, you know, like weeks prior, probably, because I had some other issue going on. But I just remember just everything going when I was like, oh, I thought I was healthy. I felt so good. And now it's over. I have to go to the hospital. And it just ruined everything, you know?
But how do you, I guess, how on earth do you explain that to a 4-year-old? Because you're like, well, I'm well. Why do I need to go to hospital when I'm well? That's not where I go with well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was full energy, but it might have been one of those things where it's like you get that burst of energy before you like don't feel well or something like that, like in the interim energy, maybe. I really don't know. I was so young, but I just remember that very vividly, of just being so happy that I felt okay for once, and that it just was immediately trashed.
Yeah, that's so difficult to explain. It's so difficult, I guess, as a child and a young child as well. I mean, that would be difficult if, you know, if you're 10 or 12 or whatever, yeah. You think, well, I'm well, why do I need to go to hospital? But I can't imagine what, like at 4, where you think, actually, you know, all of the times that you, I mean, you said there, all the times that you felt unwell, and that would have made sense. You know, I felt unwell, I'll go to hospital. And then the actual day that you're feeling well is the day you go to hospital.
Yeah, I know. I have no idea. I'll have to ask my mom about that. Like, I'm sure it was already scheduled much, you know, prior to that, and I just didn't know, because, you know, there's so much happening. I'm seeing like 80 doctors a week, and I'm constantly unconscious, and then there's so much happening. I could have just forgotten, but that was just one of the terrible moments I felt. Just crap.
So you were kind of sort of just in and out of hospitals and appointments. And I guess like a lot of people with Hirschsprungs are, you know, certainly those first few years and possibly after as well. And it's different for everyone. But certainly those first few years, you're kind of in and out and in and out of hospitals, booking surgeries, follow-up appointments, all of that stuff. Was that kind of those first few years for you too?
Yeah, I missed so much of school. I started way later than everybody else because I was in the hospital fighting for my life all the time. Or I would go to school because I was kind of okay, and then I'd get super ill by the afternoon and have to go home. So there are a lot of those days as well. Just a lot of side effects. My mom explained that I had a lot of infections that would happen post-surgeries just because, you know, I'm a baby and a kid. My immune system's already shot as it is. Plus, I keep getting opened up and all this, like, medications, and, like, I'm just getting destroyed. And so my body just was fighting for its life to try to get all this stuff out. And so even when I would have a corrective surgery follow-up, it would get infected, or I'd get super sick from a virus floating around because I had no defense system. And so that would happen just over and over and over again. I'd come home to recover and I get super sick, and then wouldn't need a surgery, but I would just get super ill. And then I'd take a week to recover and then get super sick from a cold and then get dehydrated and have to go back for fluids. So it was just that over and over and over and over again for years.
Yes. I mean, under a week to recover. I mean, that, you know, usually if people get ill at that age, you know, you take maybe a couple of days if you have cold or coughs or, you know, some kind of sickness bug. Maybe it might be a sort of 48-hour job. But a week, I mean, a week is, it's a long time.
Yeah. I was so weak. And my mom would have to, like, nurse me back to health and give me Gatorades or whatever she could on her own to try to get me back to life before the ER, if just in case we didn't have to go. But it would always be too late. And it's not her fault at all. It's just my body couldn't handle it. It was too much, you know? Yeah. I would just decline very, very quickly. And we're like, all right, back to the hospital. Let's go. Like, to the PICU. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like you said with the immune system, because we have so much surgery at such a young age. Well, I mean, again, I'll caveat this. Some of us do. Some of us, you know, are quite lucky, in inverted commas. They have to pull through and, yeah, maybe one other surgery and then that's it for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. Some of us have, you know, are easily in double figures. Some of us are a lot more. So, but I guess the more surgery you have, the harder it's going to be to sort of fight everything, and the weaker the immune system's going to be. So yeah, 20 surgeries before the age of 6. I can't imagine, you know, how battered the immune system would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Just as the volume as anything. Like, I, as soon as I had recovered, I just get sick again. And it's like, okay, back to square one already. Lose a bunch of water weight from dehydration. Yeah, I would say from 6 to 15 maybe was the pocket of recovery, basically, of like understanding diets and what I could or couldn't or shouldn't eat. Like, that was, I mean, an impossible math equation forever. It still is, actually. Well, I wouldn't say impossible. It's very difficult to see what would affect me, what would give me stomach issues or gastro, any issues like that, because it's all messed up down there. And so, like, 6 to 15 was kind of figuring that out. Okay, what is the ideal breakfast for me? What, how much fluid should I have to feel really good for the day? Okay, I can't eat that before bed. That kind of messes me up. So it's constantly evolving with that.
Wow. I mean, yeah. You say 6 to 15, like, it's a short amount of time. It's a decade, nearly. Yeah. That is a long time to figure out.
Yeah, it was a long time, yeah.
And I guess, like a lot of people in diets and foods that agree with them or don't agree with them, it's trial and error, I guess.
Yeah. But we just couldn't figure out the proper equation because it's kind of ever-changing, ever-evolving. Again, even to this day, I'm almost 32 now. I'm still dealing with that. Like, something I'll eat last year all of a sudden just destroys me today for whatever reason. And nothing changed at all. It's the exact same food, the exact same meal, It just won't agree with me all of a sudden. I know most human bodies do that too with some things, but for me, it's like every other month instead of every couple of years. You know, I have to change my diet every 2 weeks sometimes. It's just like, okay, can't eat that. Try something else. And I have to keep changing it.
That's ridiculous. I've heard of, obviously, you know, like you said, lots of people have to change diets for various reasons and whatnot. Mm. But every couple of weeks, and probably the most frustrating thing is that there's no pattern. Like, at least if it was, oh, this is acidic, so I'll, you know, avoid acidic stuff, or this is sugary or whatever it might be. At least there's a pattern there. But has anybody sort of medically wise ever sort of said to you, oh, try this or try that, or this is why this happens or this is why that happens?
I know when I was younger, my mom worked with pediatricians and the doctors and surgeons and stuff like that to kind of really work with them closely to give me an optimal diet for the most part. And she kind of overlooked that for a lot of years. But I think once I became an adult, like my own adult, I remembered a lot of it, and I would try it and keep doing it, and it would just mess me up. So I was like, I have to change it. And mess me up, I mean, like either just a stomach ache or sometimes diarrhea or sometimes acid diarrhea, even from normal thing. I'm not talking like I had 6 cakes and 40 cupcakes or something. I mean, sometimes it's just like a regular dinner and I would just be messed up till 2 a.m. And it's like, what happened? Like, I just ate this for 5 years. I don't understand. But in my adult life, I've done my own research. I haven't worked with like a dietitian or something like that personally, but a lot of it's research, like what truly helps Hirschsprung's disease specifically, because it's such a weird thing to have. And I know a lot of like oatmeal, like very slow digesting proteins is in high fiber, low sugar is the most common group of things. And even when I've tried that, sometimes it doesn't work very well. Currently, I have oatmeal every day with a banana. So they're like double slow acting things for my system. And that works pretty well. I did have eggs and potatoes for a while because I know eggs are very good and potatoes have good vitamins to absorb and stuff. But it's still just ever changing forever. Like sometimes oatmeal will give me gas one day and I have no idea why. And then it's every day is a mystery, really.
It is. It keeps us on our toes.
Yeah.
But that does make sense when you have your sort of slow release, like the oatmeal, and that does make sense, but I guess what doesn't make sense is why it then doesn't work the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, I've tried to track like maybe something I had in between that or a certain dessert I had maybe threw it off or something the day before, but my body reacts pretty quickly, meaning like if I have a cake right now, it'll affect me like an hour or two from now. It's not like a normal person where if you eat something on Tuesday and then Thursday you have gas because you're like, oh, I had that salmon the other day. Like, it's not like that for me. It's almost instant, to be honest. Like, if I eat something bad, hour or two later, I'm in the bathroom. Like, it's pretty immediate. So that's why I'm like, okay, it wasn't the breakfast. Was it the breakfast then? Because I didn't eat anything close to that would have messed me up. Like, I don't know. It's confusing. Don't know.
It's extremely confusing. I mean, at part of it, you can kind of see why that makes sense, because we have less intestine. Obviously, the more intestine you lose, the less you have, the faster it's going to travel through. So, you know, with normal people, it's going to take, you know, 24 hours or whatever, you know, to travel through. Whereas us, it's going to take a lot shorter amount of time. So it's going to have a quicker effect. So that bit, I understand. But the whole why things work one day and why things don't work the next, I don't know. I can't fathom. And in 32 years, you haven't been able to either.
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I know it could be trauma. It could be stress, as I know those definitely affect a lot of your bodily functions, which I have had a ton of growing up as well, which we can get into later. But, you know, even on the days where I'm completely calm and happy, it just messes me up. So I really don't know why. I've been tested for everything under the sun a million times and there's nothing else. It's just, I don't have anything to break it down. I don't have anything to hold it in. So it's just whatever goes in, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you did bring up
trauma there as well. And I know we wanted to get into that because I have had a look. As I mentioned at the start, you're an actor and screenwriter, and you have written some poems that I had a little look at as well, especially the one called Inner Child. I thought that was really good. A lot about sort of PTSD and CPTSD. But what is your sort of understanding, I guess, of, because everybody, when they talk about trauma, it's such a wide spectrum, but sort of what specifically speaks to you?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Mine kind of happened like waves, I would say. So obviously a lot happened to me in childhood that I don't remember at all because I was either too sick or just too young. So a lot of things I learned from my mom explaining it to me. Of like, this happened to you. You went through this. You had this happen. It was terrible. Like, she keeps it real. She's like, this was absolutely terrible. You went through terrible things. You know, this hurt. This was that. So it wasn't sugar-coated at all, which I appreciate. And so a lot of it was explained to me. But I do remember a lot of very specific moments that honestly, to this day, I cannot even fully say was reality or a dream. Because I was just so messed up so much that I can't even really tell which one I actually experienced or not. It's kind of confusing. Like some things I'll bring up, my mom won't even really remember. So I'm like, did that even happen? Or is it just like my brain trying to figure it out or something? Like, I don't know. Because it was just so terrible, which I know is a thing. But after everything was done, like after 6 years old, you know, I'm like fine now. I had a pretty great life. Like I actually like had a lot of fun. Like I would go on trips. I went to school. I had friends and everything was kind of normal. And I didn't know that anything, what trauma was. I didn't know what stress was. I didn't know what anxiety was. So I'm like, I'm better. I'm a kid, whatever. And it wasn't until I got to maybe 18 or 19 where I started to make sense of the world for the first time on my own and get my own perspective and started feeling weird sensations, which were like stress and anxiety. And I didn't know what they were. I just felt weird. I was like, whatever. I just don't feel good today or something like that. And then at 20, I think 20 or 21 is when I had my first experience of like crazy anxiety and depression. And it was basically like everything was unsuppressed for the first time that through my whole childhood, that it just all hit me at once. And I had like existential crisis, like breathing issues from the stress and anxiety, like, and nothing happened either. There wasn't an event that happened at that time either. It just all opened up and I just felt everything that I went through for so many years, I think. And I was like, holy crap. Like I feel terrible. I can't sleep. I don't want to do anything anymore. I want to tell everybody to get away from me. Like, I became very sour and mean, and I didn't know what it was. When it was like the PTSD and the trauma coming out that I just kicked under the rug for so many years. And so pretty much ever since then, 2016 to now, has been trying to unravel all that straight.
But that makes total sense, though. I mean, because what can you do at 1, 2, 3 years old? Whatever, you know, how can you make sense of the amount of complicated stuff that is going on? And I guess one of the other big things as well is the surgery. When we talk about surgery, there's a huge difference between, you know, like ankle and knee surgery and stomach surgery. Stomach surgery is so much more invasive. And again, from the research and the people I talk to, there is a lot of links between gut health and mental health, brain health.
Yeah.
Huge amounts. So I think, again, I can't quote a percentage or how much or whatever, but if you have a lot of surgery on your stomach, I think there has to be something where that is going to impact on your mental health as well. I think it has to. And also, you said, oh, I'd sort of swept it under the rug. But again, what else could you do at 6? Yeah. Like, what else were you going to do? Are you going to sort of, you know, at 5 or 6 years old, start researching, you know, trauma and PTSD? No, of course you weren't. Yeah. So it does. And I think, you're definitely not the only person I've spoken to about who has Hirschsprung's, who everything comes back. I know it happened for me as well, but everything comes back at later stage. And there is no, like you said, there's no time where it comes back. It's not at 22, this will all come back. No, it might be at 15, it might be at 35, it might never. Who knows? You know? But it does make sense that all these things that you did put away for the right reasons, it does unfortunately sometimes pop back. And that, I mean, that's, it's very difficult to make sense of Hirschsprung's, even as an adult, to kind of go, yeah, especially the whole why me type thing as well. I guess you've been through that a bit as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it's, there are some days still, I mean, where I'm just like, if I was just a normal person, I would be able to do this, this, and this, or this would be so much easier. I wouldn't have to deal with that. But it's very few and far in between. It's not every day at all, but that does happen a lot. That's why I wrote that poem. I was just like, you know, sometimes I'm just like, dude, why? Like, this sucks. Like, I just want to eat and then hang out and not have to go to the bathroom 48 times. Like, sometimes it gets really, really frustrating. But again, it's just sometimes, but it does happen. Yeah.
Yeah. But it makes sense as well, because there's in a lot of Hirschsprung circumstances, there is no rhyme and reason to it. Certainly not that we've found. I mean, yes, there are some people, obviously their parents might have had it, or their aunt and uncle may have had it, or whatever. So you can kind of trace it back and say, okay, well, I got this because it's in my bloodline or whatever. But for us, you know, it just isn't, you know, and we're that 1 in 5,000 or whatever the figure by, you know, and it's, you know, and it is just bad luck, I guess. And it's so difficult, because I guess as humans, we want to almost quantify stuff and sort of qualify things and say, well, this happened because this happened and this happened. But sometimes we can't. And I think that's one of the things, I think, that takes a long time to, because you just have to accept it, I guess, in the end, because you can't qualify it. You can't say, you know, this is this and this is why this happened. And it's really difficult to just say, well, it happened.
It's just, yeah, it's just, it's incredibly, incredibly tricky, I would imagine. But it does make sense. And it does make sense that with, and again, it's not just necessarily with Hirschsprung's, but I guess with all chronic illness as well, that feeling of, well, I wish I was just normal, whatever normal is. I think we all have a picture of what normal is, but is anybody normal, really?
It's not really.
Just like, I don't know, and I guess that the other thing as well, when it comes to Hirschsprung's, because of the times we are, or most of us, are diagnosed, we don't know any different, guess is the other thing. So we've always had this thing that nobody's ever heard of and nobody can ever spell. So it's, I guess that's possibly part of it as well. Is that what you think or no?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. But that is also kind of one of the frustrating things where it's like, I haven't had a normal day ever. Like I can't even compare. Like hearing I have lived with four roommates. Two of them are my brother and my sister-in-law. And like they'll have a lot of talks at dinner and they're like, yeah, I didn't go to the bathroom for like 2 days. It was so weird. I'm like, I can't even pretend to compute that in my neurons. Like if I don't go in a couple hours, you got to take me to the hospital. Like, I don't even know. Like, that's so not normal to me. I can't even pretend to understand that. And they're just like, yeah, it was weird. I just had like ate something weird. I'm like, how are you casual about that? That's so not like, I'm like, I'd be dead if I didn't go for 2 days. I don't understand.
Yeah. See, weird. Yeah. And, I mean, it would be, yeah, I won't go too graphic into it, but yeah, it would be bad. It would be like, bye.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I got diagnosed. I didn't go to the bathroom for like ever. And my mom was like, what the heck is going on? Like, shouldn't you have gone every 5 hours? Like, I didn't go for like a bunch of days. But that's just not normal.
No, but for everybody else, it's kind of, you know, they don't think about their stomach or they don't think about their digestive system or because it just works and it's, you know, whatever. But yeah, I guess with Hirschsprung's, we kind of have to.
Yeah, it's always on the forefront of the mind for everything.
Yeah.
Travel, diet, sleep, everything. Yeah.
Most definitely. Most definitely. I'd like to, if I may, talk a little bit about about acting and screenwriting, as we mentioned right at the very beginning. How, because again, I don't know whether it's just Hirschsprungs, but I meet a lot of Hirschsprungs slash actors. There's quite this, I mean, I don't know how many of interviews, probably about five or six, something like that. I don't know whether it's a Hirschsprungs thing. I don't know whether it's because we go through a lot of hardship, therefore it's a lot of, we can talk about a lot of stuff, but it seems to be the way it is. How did you get into acting?
My take on the thing that you just mentioned before that is that because we have so many, well, most of us have so many surgeries and our abdomen's very weak and we are weak, you can't do a lot of aggressive things in your early life. Like, I couldn't play football because if I got tackled, it could have ruptured the seams of my stitches and stuff, and I would have just bled out and died. So there were things like that I just literally could not do. And so there's kind of a way of like, okay, what can I do that's enjoyable, but that's not going to hurt me further or like keep me sick or something like that. And so one of the only things I could do was basketball, because you can't really get tackled or punched doing that. It's a very aggressively athletic sport, but that's healthy. So I kind of picked up basketball because I wouldn't get hurt. And I played actually for 17 years competitively. I wanted to be in the NBA. That was my first dream. Because that was just one of the only sports I could do without getting hurt with my abdomen. But then acting came around when I was around 12, I think. My mom kept watching. I'm a huge Jim Carrey fan. That's a huge thing to know about me. He's like my top, the top person like that inspires me. And my mom kept watching Dumb and Dumber over and over again, but I didn't know it was Dumb and Dumber yet. I just saw this movie and she wouldn't let me watch it because it was highly inappropriate and really raunchy, and like she's just like, you can't watch it until I'll let you do it at 13. You'll be old enough ish to where it won't be like illegal, you know. So she had me wait, and I just kept hearing her and my brother laugh so hard at whatever was happening, and I just didn't understand. I just wanted to see it. I'm like, what are you watching that is so enjoyable? You're laughing so hard. You're like cry laughing. And so finally I watched, I like snuck like to the side of the couch and was sat there and looked up at the TV. And I saw the scene of them. Have you seen Dumb and Dumber, by the way?
Yes, I've
seen. Okay. So I'll make sure. The scene when they're in the van with the gas man, like the antagonist. So that scene when they're driving with him, that's the first thing I saw ever of that movie, was that scene. And what I noticed so immediately was this guy, Jim Carrey, being absolutely ridiculous and loud and making faces and doing this on a public scale. Because I understood, like, hey, this is a movie. Millions of people are seeing this guy do this thing. And there's cameras. Like, he's just going crazy on camera. Like, he has no shame. It just blew my mind that someone can do that as a profession. Because growing up, I was that. I made faces. I would do acts on my own just to kind of, probably a way of coping with all the pain was just comedy. So I would just be a wacky, silly kid, high energy, doing voices, yelling. And then I saw someone do it on such a big scale and it just like affected my soul. I was like, that's something that you can do? Like, that's crazy. Like, he's just being crazy on camera. He's just yelling, doing faces. I'm like, I do that. And so that inspired me so much. And I was like, I'm doing that. Like, that's it. So, Jim Carrey.
Love it. Well, to be honest, there's not many better that you can follow. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to pick someone, go for the best.
Yeah.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, what a start, though. I mean, that's yeah. And then kind of from there, I guess you sort of kept the acting and moved a little bit more into sort of screenwriting as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did acting for quite a bit of years. I think it was like 7 or 8 years by that time. I started in 2013 officially, like actually being on sets and like being an extra and stuff like that, and fell in love with it. I'm like, just being on set, I didn't even care if I got screen time. Just being there was amazing to me. I loved the atmosphere. Like, it just felt so magical or mystical to me. It was so awesome. I didn't even care what was happening or if I got cut. I was just like, just stepping on here is awesome. And then over the years, I got some pretty cool opportunities, but then it kind of died out. And I got, I wouldn't say frustrated, but I was like, I've never tried writing. And I saw this clip of Steve Martin explain that a great way to keep up your creative flow and like your juices is to write if you're an actor. because it you're writing lines and you're writing scenes that you would perform. So it's a good way to keep it going. So I was like, all right, I guess I'll try. And I just started writing some stupid script of just, I don't know, my friends and I in situations or something, just to kind of understand how to write something. And then I just fell in love with that. I was like, this is amazing. I can write whatever I want. I can be detailed. I can be wacky. I could be crazy. I can change the names, whatever. And just that process was amazing to me. So then I stuck with that for the next few years.
I love it. I mean, because that's the thing. It's you can, there are no rules and boundaries when you write. You can be as creative as you want, you know, and that's, and like you said, you know, you can draw a lot off real life when it comes to Hirschsprungs, if you want to talk about, you know, the things that don't happen to other people but happen to us. And I guess that not necessarily, you know, writing about surgeries and whatever, but you can be as creative and you have as much creative license and freedom, I guess, as you wish.
Yeah. And that's kind of where it transitioned to poetry. I don't know if I jumped the gun there, if you're an ass, but the poetry is that I felt that I had so much to say, but I didn't want to make a comedy. I was like, I really want to say what happened. Like, I want to say what I felt. For real, and like how terrible it was, as a way of like catharticism. Like, I wanted to really make it raw and explain that this was terrible and I had no fun and I was traumatized and in pain. So I didn't want to make it a comedy anymore. I'm like, yeah, I had surgeries and whatever. I was like, no, this sucked. Like, yeah, you know, like I had a terrible life for a long time, you know? So that's where I kind of did poetry, because poetry is completely freeform. There are zero rules with that. You can make it shapes and numbers if you wanted it to. There's nothing. And so I love that freedom of it. And I just started writing, did like 20 poems in 2 weeks or something like that, to just get it all out.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, there's one in particular I think that's excellent, called Inner Child, if anybody gets an opportunity to read that. I mean, they are, when you say short poems, they are really short poems.
Yeah.
They're short, really short poems. So yeah. It's not going to take up a lot of your time to read it. But if anyone gets a chance, please do, because I think that's a wonderful explanation of things that you've been through. I really, really like that one. Really do.
Yeah. That one actually got published by a publisher in 2024. I think, or early 2025. Yeah,
fantastic. Well, that's brilliant. I mean, I think it's an excellent way of describing, well, everything that we've spent the last 40 minutes describing. Yeah. The trauma, the PTSD, the surgeries, and all sorts. But no, I think well worth a read, those ones. Where can people find them?
I only have Instagram and TikTok currently. I deactivated everything else. It's just under my name, James Bertoli, all one word, JamesBrattoli, on both of those.
Mm-hmm.
No, I do a YouTube channel, well, but worth a read. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, well worth a read if anyone has a spare 5 minutes.
Yeah, they're very short, to the point. That's why I wrote like 30 of them, because they're just all separate thoughts. I didn't want to do run on like 2-page things, which I could have done, but I was like, I'm just going to get the terrible stuff out in a few sentences, make it harsh and move on.
Fantastic. And your TikTok account is also well worth a follow, that I've seen as well. There's a lot of, if you're very into sort of funny little, again, short little clips, funny TikToks, please give Joe's a follow, because they're good.
Yeah, that's just a big outlet for me, really, to kind of cope with life, really. That's why they're just all over the place. There's not really a set anything on there, but yeah. Just whatever comes to my mind, or if I'm stressed or even happy, I'm just like, I'm just going to make something, whatever, post it, cares.
I love it. I think everyone needs some sort of outlet, whether it's something creative or TikToks or whatever it may be. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And just as we wrap up here, in terms of, I know we talked about acting, we talked about screenwriting, we talked about lots of surgeries, and social media, but in terms of sort of the future for you, are you working on anything now? Have you got anything sort of in the pipeline for the future?
Yeah, I've been writing very slowly. I've been writing a book, an autobiography more specifically, about my experience with Hirschsprungs and just my life through all the traumas and everything, through my point of view. So I wanted to explain it again, make it super raw and just straight up to the point, exactly how I felt, what I was thinking during certain times that I remember. It's basically all about the bad, essentially. I know a lot of great things did happen in my life, but I really wanted to showcase the just not fun part about, like, I just, a lot of it was just to get it out and kind of work it out in my brain. But also, I just don't like sugarcoating anything. Personally, I like, even if I'm at a job, I want someone to correct me. Just correct me. Don't be like, well, there's no, just tell me I messed up and then I can fix it. So I wanted to write something that's just very raw, to the point, like, this sucked, this hurt, this was terrible, I wanted this, I didn't like this. But I tried to nuance it as in, like, an actual book form as well. But that I've been working on for a very long time. But honestly, it's just really hard to write it emotionally, I think, is the thing that's stopping me. Every time I'll write, like, oh, I should talk about that, I'll start writing it, I'm like, fuck this. Oh man, like, I gotta go outside. Like, I just, it's hard. So, but that's something I really do want to complete in this life. So,
no, it'd be good. It'd be well worth a read when that comes out. But it makes absolute sense that you say it is going to be, yeah, as we use that word again, traumatizing. It's you know, it's not difficult to see why that's going to take a while.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one, but it's called, the working title is From Tragedy to Tragedy. Yeah, so it's just, even the title's not very exciting.
At least it's not false advertising. At least, yeah, you know, if you open that book, it's not going to be all smiles. At least people know that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like the classic, you know, the tripe is just like, or trope, sorry, is like from tragedy to, you know, bliss, or like from horrible to loving life. And I'm like, nah, this wasn't great. It's like, yeah, but it's, again, it's just about that chunk mainly, not my entire life. It's mainly about that terrible time. So I don't want people to think like I just hate my life today, but it's more of that time. This was definitely like,
but thank you so, so much for coming on. It's been an extraordinary story. And obviously, I wish you all the best with the book, with the acting, the screenwriting, and yeah, and then whatever else you want to do in your future.
Yeah, thank you for bringing me on and reaching out. And I appreciate what you're doing, because, again, it's in your profile, but people don't know it's 1 in 5,000 people are born with it. I looked it up again to make sure. It's actually more than leukemia. Leukemia is 1 in 50K. And yet no one really knows what the heck Hirschsprungs is at all, even doctors. So it's awesome that you're trying to, you know, reach out with that. It's awesome.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast, or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.